good afternoon or good evening, depending on where you are in the world, and welcome to Information Week Live for the week of April 3rd, 2016. I'm Kurt Franklin, Executive Editor at Information Week, and your host for this episode of Information Week Live. I'm joined this week by one of my favorite co-conspirators, Information Week Editor-at-Large, Charlie Babcock. Charlie, welcome to the show.
Well, Kurt, good to be here again. Always a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, you know, this has been an interesting week because there haven't really been any huge blockbuster developments in the industry, but there have been several, we'll call them smaller things that have been going on that have made it kind of interesting. To me, one of the first things that was interesting is something that I'm not sure most people would have said we needed, and that's a new browser. We have the Vivaldi browser that has been released, a browser not for the rest of us, but for the power users. I'm curious, have you heard much about the Vivaldi browser?
I've heard very little about it, Kurt, but I note that one of its authors is formerly worked on Opera, which was a good high-speed minority browser. I'm not sure what prompted him, and is still around, I believe. I don't know what prompted him to break away and try again. That in itself might be an interesting story, but it seems to me the market can stand a kind of an alternative out there setting a different standard.
Well, you know, I downloaded Vivaldi just a little while ago and have been looking at it, and one of the things that Vivaldi really seems to admit is that there are a fair number of people out there who look at more than one web page at a time. I've talked to fellow writers who had 20, 30, as many as 50 or 60 browser tabs open. And a lot of browsers start to slow down, even to the point of toppling over from their own weighty overhead by the time you get to double-digit tabs. But Vivaldi has ways of managing those tabs. They talk about tab stacks, where you can drag tabs on top of one another, and it creates a stack of tabs that you can then dive into. It's interesting that they also have notes as one of the basic abilities within Vivaldi, sort of apparently trying to cut out the need for things like Evernote and OneNote for most consumers, and for any of the people who are listening to us who are deep in the world of academe, Zotero fulfills a lot of that. So it's interesting that they seem to be very specifically going after the most heavy demand users out there. And I think that's an interesting niche to go after.
Yes, it is. You know, it would seem to be a browser designed for heavy-duty researchers. You know, you talk about double-digit pages open, and yet I occasionally am doing that, and I don't consider myself a heavy-duty researcher, certainly not an academic one. And nevertheless, I can see how that would be a very useful feature. And likewise, with the notes, in effect, you can capture a lot of information or write yourself a quick summary on something and leave it in that note and always know which web page you're referring to. Those kind of things are useful, I think, to a lot of us. And in the end, everybody is kind of becoming a heavy-duty researcher, trying to accomplish as much as they can with gathering as much information off the web as they can. It's almost like, you know, everyone's a white-collar worker suddenly with their knee-deep in research.
Oh, without question. And I think it's fascinating that people today, and I'm going to date myself here, but people today do research using web tools and learn how to use those web tools in the same way that I learned how to use things like the card catalog and the Dewey Decimal System when I was in school. It's interesting to watch those tools change over time. You know, it's interesting. I was diving a little bit deeper into Vivaldi as we've been talking, and I find it fascinating that it's built on the Chromium core. So they didn't go back and reinvent the core technology of the browser. They're on Chrome, which means that Vivaldi will use Chrome add-ons. And I thought it was fascinating when I started it up for the first time. It also asked to access my Chrome chain of credentials that have been stored for various websites. This one's going to be a fascinating one to watch. And I think it's interesting. You mentioned that as we've seen John von Techner, who was a co-founder of Opera, built that browser on someone else's core as well. I'm trying to remember. I think that may have also been on the Chrome core. The thing that Opera did that Vivaldi has not done, Opera had a fascinating strategy for speeding things up where they mirrored part of the rendering to an Opera server. And so anytime you went to a website, you were actually doing this interesting three-party dance between the web page server, your browser, and the Opera servers. If you were going back to a page that you visited frequently, this could result in some real time saving. Of course, today, all of our connections are fast enough that you don't really see people and companies talking too much about speeding up the browser anymore. All of the speed-up technology is being visited upon the web servers and the web pages themselves. But this is definitely something else in the evolution of the browser, and I'm going to be interested to see if by the end of 2016 we're still talking about Vivaldi or whether it's become one of those fascinating little experiments that just goes by the wayside. Does your crystal ball have anything clear to say about whether the world needs this browser for power users?
I don't have any particular insight into the world of browsers. It's a level that I don't normally spend a lot of time on, to be truthful, but Opera had that speed-up reputation. It was turned to as an alternative, a way to get around some of the clunkier aspects of Navigator and Explorer. The author needs, because it's based on Chromium, I imagine he's going to inherit all of the careful security work that done by Google in producing Chrome. And I don't know whether it's accurate, but for whatever reason, I tend to regard Chrome as a more secure, less likely to be corrupted instrument than its predecessors. Especially Explorer, but Explorer has come up to speed, and Navigator I also like, but somehow I think Chrome has had an edge in secure operations, and I hope that they keep it, and basing Vivaldi on Chromium is a good idea. Answers the security question, at least for now.
Well, you know, Charlie, I think it's fascinating. We could have, an entire show at least on the question of how Google has developed this reputation for being trustworthy in the security end of things. Because a lot of people really do trust Google with an amazing amount of information and do so without having an awful lot of reservations. Now, I do know people, people who I trust, folks I've known for a long time, who are very paranoid about Google and go to extreme lengths to avoid having Google as part of their personal computing infrastructure. But for the vast majority of people, it seems that Google has, in fact, built up a huge well of goodwill when it comes to security issues. And I don't know whether that's truly well-deserved or whether Google has just managed to keep quiet any massive security breaches that they've suffered. But it is interesting to see people being willing to trust this company in the way that, at the moment at least, few are willing to trust, say, the U.S. government. And talking about that, companies having trust and companies dealing with data, you have a great article that went up earlier today here at Information Week on the way that Amazon is defining their customers. Can you tell us a little bit about this piece that you've written?
Yes, I'd like to talk about that. But first, let me say I trust Google on security. I trust them a little less on privacy. They've acknowledged they will. I think they mean they will automatically scan. And in fact, they're willing to read your email. They want to know what you're interested in, what you're talking about. And I think they compile a profile on you and then use it in selling ads to advertisers, knowing what your interests are, something like that. Apple does the same thing, and I don't see the huge Apple community expressing nervousness over the security or the privacy issue. But I'll tell you, my wife and I went to a lamp store looking for a particular kind of lamp. And the next day, ads for that style of lamp started appearing in my browser window when I was surfing the web. How they knew what to put there, I don't know. But it was so well targeted that I got a creepy feeling that there was an eye in the sky watching me everywhere I go. Anyway. Let's move on to Amazon. This, of course, is always a favorite topic. To me, Amazon is doing a number of things that are going to keep it ahead of the competition for many years. I call it defining the consumer of the future rather than chasing that party. Other businesses are going to be pursuing the consumer of the future. Amazon is sort of setting the terms on which they would like to operate and go about their business. One of those things is they will expect to find whatever they are searching for and would like to buy on a site, much like Amazon's. Amazon has 70,000 third parties who make over 100,000 a year in selling their wares there. So that is quite a marketplace, along with all the things that Amazon negotiates for and brings to the marketplace itself. Creating that marketplace, you will need a very effective platform that businesses have confidence in. Amazon has clearly got that. It would take years of effort to build up that kind of reputation and then try to build up that same marketplace if you are not Amazon. I just don't see many people trying to do it. The one party that is doing it, perhaps in spades, is Alibaba in China, but name a couple more. It just takes a tremendous amount of effort and a tremendous customer base to have the resources to do that. And then within the massive online business that they've got and millions of customers, they've created what I would kind of consider a country club set. It's their Amazon Prime customers, the people who pay for the privilege of doing business through Amazon. The analogy I would draw is if you go to Walmart and the greeter, instead of shaking your hand, asks you for $99 to enter the store, what's going to happen to most Walmart customers? They're going to turn around and walk away. Amazon is doing that with the Prime customers. They pay $99 a year. I've tried to translate that into Amazon's revenues. It produced $107 billion in revenue last year. Prime customers provided somewhere between $5.3 and $5.4 billion of that. So it's not an overwhelming amount of revenue in terms of the Amazon business, but it's free revenue in a sense. It's Amazon does for Prime customers what it has to do anyway, only it does it a little better and grants them some special rights and privileges, and it's created this spending class within the overall mass of Amazon customers that appear to be loyal. They renew that $99 fee year after year. Amazon is trying to sell them special content, somewhat the way Netflix does, original content financed by Amazon. The Man in the High Castle is a series that shows what it was like in the United States after it lost World War II, a fascinating storyline. And that's been a hit and very popular among the Prime customers. And there's a lot of other specialized content in there that only Amazon is providing, and it gives the Prime customer something to talk about and something to feel a bit special about, since they get Prime Video usage as part of their membership. So Amazon is in effect saying this is what the consumer of the future is going to look like. They're going to be catered to in these ways. They will get free delivery. They will get fast delivery either within 2 days, or if they would like to pay a little bit, they can get it even faster than that. I can see all kinds of additional privileges and special services flowing out of this basic platform that Amazon has already got set up. Someday you're a Prime customer, you may take an Amazon delivery, you may hand off a package you wish to ship someplace to the same party, and it will go out as if it were UPS or FedEx, and you're dealing with your very familiar through your familiar Amazon interface and with your Amazon delivery person, etc., etc. You can kind of see where this is going. Customers with special privileges, used to very quick delivery, used to quick ordering and a sort of instant gratification in getting what they want.
Well, you know, Charlie, it's interesting that you're talking about Amazon and Amazon Prime. And I'll admit, we've been Amazon Prime members for a number of years. And to me, it was fascinating looking at some analysis that folks did, talking about how much more Amazon Prime members spend than run-of-the-mill people who use Amazon.
Yes.
You know, the understanding is that when it comes to the free two-day shipping that you get as an Amazon Prime member, obviously that's a cost, a fixed cost, that's going to happen every time you buy something. But Amazon feels that you're going to buy enough extra that it makes up for the free shipping. And certainly in my case, there are times when I need something small, and I will just hop onto Amazon, order it from through Amazon Prime, and not think about it. Now, I did think it was interesting. One of the people who's participating in our online discussion that goes along with the live broadcast of this show on Friday afternoons has wondered whether to use your analogy, whether standard Amazon might be to Walmart what Amazon Prime is to Sam's Club. And I wonder if that's the sort of analogy. And again, I'll admit, I am a Sam's Club member. We became a Sam's Club member when we had a hungry young male in the household with us. We're being able to buy, cereal in 4 cubic foot boxes made a lot of sense. But there is that notion that by paying something, you get access to both additional goods and services and a different kind of experience. Are people willing to pay for the additional experience? I think they are, obviously. In my case, I am. And to me, it seems one of those additional things that Amazon and other online retailers can do in response to one of the advantages that brick-and-mortar stores now have. We're seeing brick-and-mortar stores understand that for most of them, simply acting as a warehouse where you keep your stuff until you're ready to buy it and take it home doesn't have the kind of margin that it once did. They really have to provide a better experience than you can get online in order to justify both the trouble of getting in your car and going there and typically the higher price they have to charge. Do you think that Amazon really is working not to identify and make this customer so that they can personalize the experience a little more and provide a richer experience and therefore get more sales?
That probably sums up rather neatly exactly what they're doing. And in fact, they're interested in those customers who are comfortable doing things online, who wish to do things online, who like the time savings of doing things online. They're catering to that mentality and serving it better than a Walmart could, even if it had automated systems and could deliver somewhat in the fashion that Amazon does. The Walmart customer isn't necessarily going to want to, let's say, buy insurance online or make travel plans online or who knows, any number of healthcare will inevitably become more of an online experience. Will that someday be channeled through Amazon vendors making use of Amazon deliveries, et cetera, et cetera? The possible permutations of what Amazon is doing are nearly endless if you've captured that online-oriented customer, the party who would much prefer not to go through several people or they'd like to answer their own questions online and then make a decision online. They will also tend to spend more online. The average Prime customer is spending $1,100 a year with Amazon, and that number is growing. We are Prime customers, I somewhat reluctantly, but the advantages are just offsetting any conceivable resistance to the expense. How much do you have to pay to be in Sam's Club?
It's a sliding scale depending on what kind of membership you have, but I think that it starts at around $50 a year, and goes up from there depending on what class membership you have and whether it's personal or business, that sort of thing. But I think it starts at around $50 a year. And like I said, if you have a recurring need to buy food in survivalist size quantities, they do have certain other things that are decent buys, it makes a great deal of sense. And we have kept it up even after we're no longer feeding an adolescent male. But But it is interesting, the various parallels that come and go between the online world and that of the brick-and-mortar stores.
Well, Amazon builds a few distribution centers compared to the number of Walmart big-box stores that are need to be located close to population centers. There's a logistics issue there that Amazon, through greater use of electronic systems and modern distribution, might capture more of the overall market in the long run. We have to see how many people, you know, want to order their breakfast cereal off their phone, I guess.
Well, you know, I find it fascinating that we're talking about delivering these things as a modern convenience. I remember having conversations with my father-in-law, who had spent part of his childhood in Pittsburgh before the Second World War. And he talked about going downtown and shopping with his mother. And the normal way of doing things was that you would go to the department store, make your selection and your purchases, and then go back, leave your purchases at the store and take the trolley or the streetcar to your shopping destinations and do all of your shopping, including, in many cases, your grocery shopping. Go back home, and later that day or the next day, your products would be delivered to your home. And so I think it's fascinating that while we have eliminated a piece of the experience, in many ways this is a return to a much older way of doing business, at least in the urban centers of the country. And one of those everything old is new again sorts of things that we run into in our industry.
But if you were to look at the respective business expense of getting the consumer to decision and then making a delivery, I think there'd be quite a difference in scale in terms of what Amazon is doing versus the old Pittsburgh way.
Oh, without question. The department stores in Pittsburgh or any U.S. city at that time tended to be localized to that city. And while they had some decent distribution within the urban confines, Google is a rarity in the scope of its distribution system for retailing in the U.S., without question.
Mm-hmm. Now, Amazon. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. I misspoke. Thanks for rescuing me on that. Before we go, and we are getting close to the end of our time here, I do want to make mention of just another couple of quick things that have been going on in the world of IT. One of them, if you are out there and you have anything going on with Flash on your system, make sure you're updating. There's a 0 day that's out there, and Adobe has issued an emergency update for that, so make sure your Flash player is updated if you're still using that technology. And speaking of updates, one of the things that is starting to hit the international press is the Panama Papers. And this is where a large international law firm, headquartered in the nation of Panama, had their server hacked and a huge trove of documents was taken and basically crowdsourced to journalists in about 50 different nations who each took a piece of it and went through it. It's now coming back that to the surprise of approximately no one who pays attention to these things, lots and lots of world leaders and world business leaders have offshore accounts in various shadow companies around the world, in the various little nations, or sometimes larger nations, that have friendly banking regulations. To me, the fascinating part of this and the piece that is relevant for the IT community is that, by all accounts, the way the hackers got into the law firm was by exploiting a known vulnerability in a content management system called Drupal. This was one that they, as I said, it was widely known, and the law firm apparently had not patched or updated their version of Drupal in a little more than 3 years. So it was effectively wide open. Charlie, I don't know if you've been following anything about the Panama Papers, but I know that you do cover open source software pretty diligently. From all of that coverage, have you gleaned any wisdom about updating and keeping things current in terms of versions and patches?
Well, you need to update open source with some regularity, and it's very clear that companies with people trained to do this have a pretty good standard of it, especially for things like Linux and the Navigator browser or languages. But small outfits, mom and pop outfits, places where technology is very much a second or third priority to keeping the business wheels spinning smoothly, things don't get updated regularly, and relying on humans to do it is a very well established method that will cause you to fail. We're getting more and more automated ways of creating, of making sure software is updated. Especially people who build containers can invoke automated systems that go out and check whether the component being added to the container is the correct updated version or is it one that contains vulnerabilities. And if it is, then an alert is sent, or even possibly intervention is staged where the correct updated component is brought in and you end up with a system with only the latest open source software, a good thing. It's just not possible for busy people to track the thousands of permutations of open source that keep being issued with small updates, major updates, what have you, unless it is a major business concern. And in too many places, it just isn't.
Well, I think this is one of those things where it makes sense if you aren't big enough to have a staff that can keep up with this. This is the time to think about doing updates as a service. Look at someone who can keep track of all this for you. And for many people and many organizations, this is something that argues in favor of going with a cloud service provider, because those cloud service providers generally do have the wherewithal to make sure that everything is patched and kept up to date. That's certainly something to make sure is part of any service level agreement you have with a service provider.
Absolutely, and the cloud service provider has a simpler environment than you do. They purposely limit the number of things that they're trying to deal with. When they're done with one version of an operating system, all copies of it are eliminated, the new one implemented, and then they only have one thing to keep up to date, as opposed to the 6 or 8 or 12 that the typical enterprise ends up operating because they couldn't phase out an older version. It worked too well with the older application and the older application server, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, Charlie, this for a fairly slow week, there was certainly plenty to talk about, and I very much appreciate you taking time out of a busy day of covering lots of important stuff for Information Week to join me here on Information Week Live. Now, I've got to ask, what's on your radar coming up for the next week or so? What should we be looking out for you to have under your byline at Information Week?
Well, I'll try to follow up that comment that Amazon is defining the consumer of the future by taking a look at Amazon Echo, how it's invading households, and how it is can become a more general purpose appliance than just a Amazon ordering machine. It's a new interface, voice activated, and Amazon is going to make good use of that once it's installed in the home.
Well, we will look forward to that article. And I know that you also let people know what you're doing through your social media presence. How can people find you on the various social media sites?
I think Twitter is the main one. The go to Babcock CW is my Twitter handle, at Babcock CW.
Well, thank you so much. We appreciate you joining us today. And I apologize to our listeners. I have another phone in my office that's decided to ring at this point. So if you hear that, if you're calling me right now, I'm ignoring you. And if you're not, I'm sorry for the noise. As in terms of what I'm going to be covering, I've got several interesting use stories. Going out, talking to users, doing some more in the world of DevOps, covering several things, including a piece on how a software provider, CompuWare, who is big in the mainframe software world, has shifted their entire corporate culture to an agile culture, from one that was deep in the old mainframe waterfall method of doing, well, pretty much everything. Really interesting conversation I had with them, and be featuring that in the next week. In addition, coming up in the next couple of weeks, we're going to have the beginning of a new series of radio shows. We're going to have the Information Week Elite 100 Radio, where I talk to a number of companies who have been nominated and are now finalists for the Information Week Elite 100. We've got CIOs, in some cases CEOs, executives, and the managers who worked on and headed up the projects for which the companies were nominated. That's going to be some interesting stuff. Like I said, I've already begun those interviews. Speaking of the Information Week Elite 100, this is a conference taking place May 2nd and 3rd at the Four Seasons Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada. It is going to be the place where CIOs and senior IT executives come together to hear one another talk about the projects that they have built in the past year, the cultures that they've established, the issues that they face. It is going to be a great conference. It always has been in the past, and this year will be even bigger and better than ever before. For more information on this, please go to informationweek.com, look up at the top of the page, and you'll see the Elite 100 badge. Well, it's been a great half hour. Thank you for joining us. For Charlie Babcock, I'm Kurt Franklin, saying thanks so much for being with us. Hey, we'll see you next time.